You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The U.S. Supreme Court issued a landmark decision in 2008 in the case of District of Columbia versus Heller. The court decided in a 5-4 vote that an individual's right to bear arms exists in the United States Constitution. The case and the unique battle over gun ownership and gun control in America is chronicled in a new book by Adam Winkler called Gunfight. It's published by W.W. Norton, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Winkler to our show today. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
You call the Second Amendment maddeningly ambiguous. In what ways?
Well, the Second Amendment provides that a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. You can see the problem with my description. There's too many commas to really make much sense of it. So it's been maddeningly ambiguous for a long time, and the two sides have contended, one side focusing on the second part of the Second Amendment, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, insisting that that's a individual right that imposes strict limits on gun control. The other side that takes more seriously the first part of the Second Amendment, the part about the well-regulated militia, and thinks that it's not about an individual right to bear arms, but only about protecting state militias and not an individual's right.
I was interested to note that there's a similar thing in the New York Constitution, Article 4 of the New York Constitution. It doesn't have as many commas. It has a slight word change. And I don't know whether it means something different. It says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms cannot be infringed.
Well, I don't know if that was done intentionally to make a big difference. But one of the things that I talk about with the Second Amendment is that, and you pointing out this other constitutional amendment is an important signal, that we talk so much about the right to bear arms in terms of the Second Amendment, but that's not the only constitutional basis for the right to bear arms. In fact, every state has its own constitution, and almost every state protects an individual's right to bear arms apart from militia service.
Well, the other amendments in the Bill of Rights don't seem as opaque. Why was the Second Amendment written in that way?
Well, the Second Amendment was written because the Founding Fathers did not like standing armies and wanted to have a citizens' militia where individuals, when called out to serve, would go home, grab their guns, and be ready to fight in an instant. Hence the Minutemen that we're so familiar with. They thought that the citizen militia would be the national defense force, and they were fearful that the president or the federal government might try to disarm those militias in the same way that they had seen English kings do in England in their own experience as Englishmen, and they did not want to give that power. So they protected the right of the people to keep and bear arms, primarily to protect state militias from being overrun by the federal government.
Of course, that was before we had a standing army, and we had all sorts of other things happen in this country. By the way, I got that wrong. It wasn't in the New York State Constitution. It's in the New York State Civil Rights Law. Mm. But in the end, it makes it clear that a lot of places felt that this was an important right to give to people.
That's right. Virtually every state, when it joined the Union, had a provision for the right to bear arms. Not every single one, of course, but it was a very, very common feature in the 1800s especially. And then it was very clear that that right was a right of individuals to have guns to protect themselves from criminals or wrongdoers.
Do you think the Supreme Court's ruling in the District of Columbia versus Heller finally declared a winner in the ongoing culture war of the guns?
I think it declared a winner in some ways, but I think it declared that both sides were winners. I see the Heller case really as a very moderate opinion. When it was first decided, there were a lot of gun control advocates who were upset. They thought this was going to be the end of gun control as we know it. There were some gun rights advocates who were incredibly enthused, thinking this was the end of gun control as we know it. But the Supreme Court was very clear to say while there is an individual right to have a firearm for self-defense, there are restrictions that the government can impose on that right that are perfectly legitimate. And a very important paragraph in the opinion set forth a long list of different kinds of laws that were not called into question by the Second Amendment, and that captured most of modern American gun control.
On the other hand, the decision was 5-4. What did the dissenters argue?
Well, the dissenters argued for this militia theory of the Second Amendment, that it was only about the collectivity of people acting in the form of the state militias. That has been this big historical debate. But, you know, as I've said, the right to bear arms does not entirely turn on the Second Amendment. And indeed, one of the stories I tell in Gunfight, my book, is that the 14th Amendment, one of our most important provisions that protects equal protection of the laws and has been the key to expanding rights, was designed in part to protect the right of the freedmen to have guns for personal protection, which was being threatened by Southern states after the Civil War.
They were imposing gun control to prevent freed slaves from having firearms because they were afraid, I guess, that they would be used as a form of revenge.
One of the interesting things I found in researching the book was the way in which race and racism have tainted gun control laws over the centuries. It's not unlike most areas of American law that's been used as a tool of racial oppression. The Founding Fathers had gun control laws that were racially discriminatory, banned slaves and free blacks from owning guns, lest they revolt. And all through the South before the Civil War, blacks were never allowed to own guns. But during the Civil War, they got their hands on guns for the first time, and Southern states were determined to get rid of those guns and disarm the blacks.
Didn't Ronald Reagan support gun control when he was governor of California because he was trying to disarm the Black Panthers?
Yeah, that's right. I tell the story of one of the most amazing, remarkable incidents in the history of guns in America, which was a day in May 1967 when 30 Black Panthers show up at the California state capitol with loaded rifles, pistols, and shotguns in their hands, and they march right up the front steps, in through the door. There's no security that they need to go through or metal detectors. Walk right into the legislative chamber that's in session with their loaded firearms. They weren't there to commit violence. They were there to protest a proposed gun control law that was designed to take guns out of their hands. That law, ironically, was supported by conservatives in California who were pushing for more restrictive gun control laws, including the governor, Ronald Reagan.
So when did that change? Because it seems to me it's around the 70s that we hear about the NRA for the first time, even though the NRA has been around since something like 1800.
That's right. The NRA started right after the Civil War.
Oh, the 1870s.
It was right after the Civil War, started by two former Union soldiers, one of whom was a reporter for the New York Times, not exactly a fan of gun rights these days, designed for marksmanship. The two men were convinced that the war lasted so long because Union marksmanship was so poor compared to Confederate soldiers who were much more used to having guns. And so they wanted to increase training. The NRA, through most of its history, actually supported gun control laws, wrote and drafted restrictive concealed carry laws that were passed in state after state after state in the 1920s and 30s. And I even tell, there's a great story, the president of the NRA in the 1930s, a man named Carl Frederick, he is asked to testify when Congress is considering the first major federal gun control law, which is going to impose serious restrictions on access to machine guns and sawed-off shotguns, gangster weapons that were popular during the Prohibition era. And he's asked to testify, and he comes and he's asked, does the Second Amendment have any effect on this law? And his answer from the perspective of today is astounding. He said, quote, "I have not given it any study from that point of view." So this is the head of the NRA. And so it was a very different time. It's not until the late 1960s, in part because of laws like the Black Panther Law, supported by Reagan, that started a backlash and created the modern gun rights movement.
My guest is Adam Winkler, who is a professor of constitutional law at the University of California in Los Angeles. And he's written a book called Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, published by Norton. The court has decided on the right to own a gun many times over the years. Why do we have to keep on going back to it?
Well, actually, part of the story of the Second Amendment is how the Supreme Court, well, it's ruled on it in the last couple years, some major cases, the Heller case that I talk about a lot in my book, the dramatic story of that litigation and how these lawyers were pursuing the NRA's vision of the Second Amendment, but the NRA was fighting against them. And there's been a subsequent case called McDonald dealing with the city of Chicago's ban on handguns. But the truth is, before that, the Supreme Court had not clearly ruled on the meaning of the Second Amendment ever. They had mentioned it in passing, but most cases that raise Second Amendment issues In the Supreme Court were desperate appeals by drug dealers or other people, criminals caught with guns. And the, you know, United States against crackhead is not a promising vehicle for interpreting the Second Amendment. And in fact, the court didn't interpret the Second Amendment until it had a case that was designed really as a civil rights case with really good sympathetic plaintiffs brought by lawyers who are not seeking to get a criminal out of jail, but to provide someone personal protection.
Was Heller then an ideal plaintiff?
Well, Heller was not in some ways, but the lawyers behind the case went and recruited a whole bunch of plaintiffs, about half a dozen plaintiffs, to be in this case. And Dick Heller was one of them, but he was not the one they put front and center when the case first started. That was a woman named Shelley Parker, and her story was such that a devoted pacifist would have given her a gun. She was an African-American woman living in a drug-ridden neighborhood in Washington, D.C., and she was like a one-woman drug-fighting force. She would call the police every time she saw a drug dealer. She would go out on the street and, you know, cause problems for the drug dealers, and they were threatening her life, and the criminals on the street were threatening her and vandalizing her place. And a police officer came to her apartment one day and advised her she should buy a gun, even though it was illegal. The police officer's like, that's what you should do, is you should buy a gun. And Heller, it turns out, because of some issues with a legal doctrine of standing, which is just about who can bring a case and who can't bring a case, most of the plaintiffs were kicked out of the case by a court, and leaving the lawyers only with Dick Heller. And he was more of an anti-government guy, and they had to try to tell him to tone it down when he was before the cameras.
Wasn't a large part of the Supreme Court's decision in Heller based on originalism? The idea that the framers actually intended for everyone to be able to own a gun?
Indeed. When it was first issued, it was declared to be a triumph of originalism, and in some ways the crowning achievement of Justice Antonin Scalia's fight for originalism as the dominant way of thinking about how do you interpret the Constitution. But I think it was much more complex than that. While the court did look to history and originalist history to find what the right was protected by the Second Amendment, a right of individuals to bear arms, where the rubber hits the road when it came to what kinds of laws the Second Amendment allows and doesn't allow, what kinds of gun control can be permitted, the court really looked to modern-day developments in gun law.
When former Justice John Paul Stevens was on Fresh Air yesterday, Terry Gross asked him about the Heller ruling. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
And I think it's fairly clear that the framers expected the states to have the last say on what kind of use of the people to keep and bear arms should be authorized. They certainly didn't expect, in my judgment, federal judges to have last word on what kind of firearms states could authorize for themselves.
So it's interesting that Stevens is making an originalist argument there, isn't he?
That's right. And his dissent in the Heller case was very much an originalist argument. It's part of the flaws, perhaps, of originalism. Justice Scalia thinks that originalism applies itself and answers all the questions without any dispute. But Heller is a perfect example that you can approach it with originalism and come to very, very different answers because the historical materials are by their nature ambiguous.
And this brings us into the whole business of the 10th Amendment and how people have argued both sides of that.
Yeah.
Does the 10th Amendment, is that ever invoked in discussing gun control?
The 10th Amendment is not invoked all that often because of the Second Amendment being there quite prominently. But one thing I'd say, and I think in response to Justice Stevens, there's no doubt that the Second Amendment, like all of the other Bill of Rights, the first eight provisions of the Bill of Rights, were all designed to limit what the federal government can do and not limit what states could do. That's why the First Amendment says Congress shall pass no law. It's a restriction on Congress, not on what the state of Massachusetts can do. Those Bill of Rights provisions were made applicable to the states through the 14th Amendment, when after the Civil War, when the southern states continued to deny freedmen their rights, the framers of the 14th Amendment set out to say, no, we want all of those Bill of Rights provisions protected against state infringement, too. And that includes the First Amendment. That's why Boston can't limit your right of free speech, because the First Amendment applies to them. What Stevens is not mentioning there is that the 14th Amendment requires the Second Amendment to be applied to the states, too. The Constitution's changed since the Second Amendment.
You write that the Supreme Court's decision bore some of the same ironic contradictions explored in the novel Catch-22. In what ways?
Well, of course, Catch-22 involves those great paradoxes where you have to win to lose or lose to win. And there's ways in which the Heller case sort of reflects that. I mean, it's obviously a remarkable triumph for the modern gun rights movement to finally have the Supreme Court respond to this social movement, declare that the right that they've been seeking is constitutionally protected in a world where it was pretty ambiguous for many, many years. At the same time, gun control advocates have won. There have been over 400 federal court cases on the constitutionality of any number of different kinds of gun control laws just since 2008, since the Heller case. Federal courts have been inundated with these cases. They've upheld almost every single law that's been challenged.
Despite Heller?
Yeah, because they're saying that Heller protects a basic right to have a firearm in your home, but it was there's not many places that deny you that right. And in fact, now there's no place in the United States, no city or state, that denies anyone the right to have a handgun in their home. So no one's violating the right identified in Heller.
It's just when you have it somewhere else. The justification for the stop and frisk actions of New York City's police is that they're looking for hidden firearms.
And that's the next big question that the Supreme Court's going to have to face, is does the right to bear arms extend outside of the home and into the public streets?
And we'll get back to that and more after we take a little break. My guest is Adam Winkler, professor of constitutional law at the University of California, Los Angeles. UCLA is the other name for that university. He's written a book called Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. It is published by Norton. Stay with us. We're back with Adam Winkler, who is a professor of constitutional law at UCLA and the author of a book called Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. It's published by Norton. How much of an impact do you think the Heller ruling will have on everyday life in America?
Well, I think the immediate impact of the case is to subject all the nation's gun control laws to judicial scrutiny. And so, like I said, there's been hundreds of cases that have been decided so far. But I'm hopeful that the biggest impact it will have, so far it hasn't had a big impact on gun control because the courts have upheld most of the laws, but I'm hopeful that the biggest impact it might have is to help change the dynamics of the gun debate. It really takes disarmament off the table, and that's really been part of the real problem. The right feels that the gun rights supporters feel that the government's coming to take their guns, and they can't support modest laws in the meantime because it's a slippery slope. And this makes that slope a little less slippery.
Had the D.C. handgun ban that was overturned in Heller been particularly effective?
Well, the ban was passed in 1976, and it wasn't effective in two ways. When it was adopted, even the city council members who supported it, like Marion Barry, who said at the time that this law is not going to take one gun out of the hands of one criminal. And he was a supporter of the law. They knew it wasn't going to reduce gun crime, and it was certainly not successful in reducing gun crime. A decade later, Washington, D.C. was known as the murder capital of the United States, as the crack wars really led to increases in violence. But the reason why the D.C. City Council supported the law was really not because of gun violence, but because they thought that we could be a model for all other places to start banning guns, and that this would be the start of a movement to get rid of all the guns in America in civilian hands. And it was also pretty obviously not a success on that score either.
Well, the NRA has repeatedly attacked Barack Obama for having a secret agenda to take away guns. Is that backed up by any facts?
Well, 2 years into his presidency, the Brady Center, the nation's leading gun control organization, gave President Obama an F rating. Because actually, in his first couple years in office, he had loosened gun laws, allowing guns in national parks.
On Amtrak.
And on Amtrak as well, pulling back a Bush-era administration post-9/11 restriction on Amtrak travel with firearms. You know, right now there's the big issue for the Obama administration with regards to guns is this scandal over Operation Fast and Furious and whether there was illegal gun running to Mexico. I think that's going to be his main problem with the gun owners in the next election.
There was a rush on gun purchases after the 2008 election. Was there so much fear about what Obama was going to do?
I think there was genuine fear that Obama was going to push for laws that restricted access to firearms, maybe a new assault weapons ban. One of the interesting ironies of gun control throughout American history is that when new gun control laws are proposed, it often spurs the purchase of new guns because gun owners feel like, oh, I have to buy now while we're in the period before they're outlawed.
But all of this is linked to politics in another way, isn't it? Because the NRA is also seen as a strong supporter of the Republican Party. And so does Barack Obama, as a Democrat, automatically become somebody who is going to take away your guns?
Well, it certainly seems that way. And remember when they
Does the NRA give Obama an F as well?
You know, it's interesting. Apparently, President Obama asked Wayne LaPierre, the head of the NRA, to just come and have a one-to-one, off-the-record meeting with him in the White House, and Wayne LaPierre refused to meet with him. So I guess that's his view of it. Maybe that's his grade for the president. But I don't think President Obama's really interested in gun control at all right now, because I don't think he sees it as a political winner to push for new gun control laws, especially the kinds of proposals we've been talking about really won't have a big impact on gun violence. And so it'll have a huge electoral impact on Democrats, but it won't have a huge effect on crime.
And many Democrats have been opposed to gun control or have thought that probably the best way to get elected in some states is to support gun ownership.
That's absolutely right. And I don't know that for all of those people, it's just a strategic political choice. I mean, it may be a stance on principle, too. I don't know. But that's been important. I mean, there's some Democrats like Harry Reid would really never have risen to power in Nevada had he been opposed to gun rights. There are some places where that's really those voters are very intense, and they make that the only basis upon which they cast their vote.
You write that Wayne LaPierre was an unlikely choice to head the NRA. Why do you think he was chosen?
Well, Wayne LaPierre was an unlikely choice in the sense that if you were to look at him, he didn't look like a gun guy. He looked like a corporate executive.
Well, Charlton Heston looked like a gun guy. Yeah, was he just a figurehead?
Well, Charlton Heston he was in a symbolic role. He wasn't in a policymaking or organization running role. I think he was the chairman of the board at one point, which, as you know from other organizations, is not necessarily the person who's doing all the work. And Wayne LaPierre, the executive vice president, is the real power of the NRA. And they've had a series of very interesting and innovative leaders. But since the 1970s, when the NRA underwent a major revolt of the membership, it's been very hardline executive vice presidents, Wayne LaPierre, Harlan Carter, and others, who've really become diehard opponents of gun control.
You also write that Wayne LaPierre is proud to be seen as an extremist. Does he say he's an extremist?
Well, he does, and I don't know. Some people make a lot out of that statement, but, you know, I think of myself an extremist on civil rights when it comes to anti-racial discrimination. I consider myself an extremist on women's rights to choose or bodily integrity. So, I don't know. I think we're all pretty much extremists when it comes to the rights we really, really love and really want to protect. I do say that the answer for most rights, and in particular the Second Amendment, is finding a way to move beyond those extremes and to come to compromise positions.
What's the relationship between the NRA and local and state law enforcement agencies? Have they drifted into conflict on some issues?
Well, it used to be that the police were the biggest supporters of the NRA. No one understands the value of having a firearm next to you for self-protection more than police officers. They have it every day. And it used to be that, because the NRA has always been very active involved in training, that if you needed to learn how to shoot when you joined the police force, they'd send you to the NRA to get trained. And it's still the most police officers are still trained by NRA-certified instructors. So the NRA is very active with the police, but that alliance has really been strained in the last couple decades, in part because of the new hardline approach that the NRA has taken that has led to opposition to popular laws like bans on so-called cop killer bullets and opposition to the Brady background check system. So those are laws that a lot of police chiefs think are really essential for combating crime, especially in urban areas.
In the past, the NRA didn't oppose all gun laws and any gun control measures that like banning bullets and things like that.
Well, right. As we mentioned, the NRA in the 1920s and 30s was writing and drafting restrictive gun control laws and supported the National Firearms Act of 1934, the first major federal gun control law, and then supported the Gun Control Act of 1968, which was the next major federal law.
But now they see this as a slippery slope.
Well, what happened was in the 1970s, the leadership of the NRA decided they wanted to retreat from political activity, move the headquarters to Colorado Springs, and focus on outdoors activities and hunting. This really upset a growing group of dissidents within the members who didn't think guns were about hunting, but about personal protection in a time of growing and rising crime rates. And these dissidents staged a coup at the 1977 annual membership meeting, very dramatic, where overnight they ousted the entire leadership of the NRA, installed their own people, recommitted to a new view of that focused on political lobbying against gun control and a hardline view of the Second Amendment.
A listener writes, you're a professor at UCLA, and Los Angeles has a major problem with gun violence. What kinds of options are open to the city leaders there now?
Well, I think a lot of options are still open to city leaders. The Supreme Court has really, all the Supreme Court has said is that you cannot ban people from owning a firearm within your own home for personal protection, and that only applies to law-abiding people. I think we have to remember that the gun problem in America is not a problem of ordinary gun owners. It's a problem of primarily, when it comes to homicides, gang members and recidivist criminals. And those are the reasons why those cities like Los Angeles have gun problems. And the answer is in solving the gang problem probably more than solving the gun aspect of it.
Well, the gun rights lobby has framed firearms as a crime deterrent for a long time, but they've also started promoting them as a way to fight back against so-called government tyranny. Did that begin with the Waco incident?
There's no doubt that that element of the modern gun rights movement was stimulated by incidents like Waco and Ruby Ridge, where many in the gun rights community thought that it was proof that the government was going to run roughshod over your rights. There is an element of this sort of, it's called the insurrectionist idea of the Second Amendment, throughout the history of the Second Amendment. Remember, the Founding Fathers were revolutionaries. They valued firearms because they used firearms to fight against an unjust and oppressive government. I think they hoped that the Constitution would solve those problems, but that idea of insurrectionism in the Second Amendment, while I don't endorse it and I don't think the courts will endorse it, is part of the long history and rhetoric of the Second Amendment.
Well, a listener asks what the, quote, well-regulated militia, quote, close quote, part of the amendment was intended to require.
Well, we remember that the Founding Fathers, not liking a standing army, believed that citizens were the militia.
But well-regulated? Doesn't that mean something quite different than me having a gun in my home?
It does. It does refer to you having a gun, the militia part. You are part of the militia. And federal law has, ever since the founding era, continued to declare that men between the ages of 18 and 45 are de facto by law members of the citizens' militia. The well-regulated part was that part of the founding fathers' gun control. Gun control is not a modern 20th century invention. The founding fathers imposed demanding requirements through militia laws on gun owners, requiring them to appear at mandatory musters, for instance, where they and their guns would be inspected, and they would be trained on how to use the guns and which guns they should have, because, again, they were the National Defense Force. So well-regulated is part of the story of the Second Amendment, and it's not just about the right of the people to keep and bear arms. It's also about the well-regulated people.
And why do they object to the background checks?
The modern NRA, Wayne LaPierre, first of all, I think that they fight almost any reasonable gun proposal because they think it's going to put us on a slippery slope towards total disarmament. So that's the basic.
Outlawing dumb bullets and background checks is part of that slippery slope?
Absolutely part of that slippery slope. Now, the NRA pushed for revisions in the Brady background check laws that were eventually adopted and was able to support the idea of having some kind of background check. Now, in part because of the NRA's pushing, there's an instantaneous check that happens for most gun purchases, at least all purchases by a federal licensed dealer. And that's an instantaneous check that you can do through a computer system. And that's a pretty effective system. It's stopped well over a million potential gun buys so far.
On the other hand, there have been lots of videos made of people buying guns at gun shows. people who they did not check, and we've seen a number of shootings by people who should have been stopped and who weren't because nobody bothered to check.
There is definitely a problem with the background check system that we have in America. We call it, you hear about the gun show loophole. It's a little bit of a misleading term because gun shows have to operate under the same rules as gun sellers everywhere else in the country. But the reason why we talk about gun shows is because the federal law requires only federally licensed dealers, people who have a license to deal with firearms from the federal government, to do the background checks. But anyone else, if you have some firearms of your own, you just sell them occasionally, or you want to sell them more regularly but don't feel like dealing with the hassles of government licensing, you go to and you can sell the guns at gun shows, and you don't have to conduct a background check. And we should close that loophole. It's more than just for gun shows. It's about all private sales.
Gun control advocates point to the fact that the United States has the highest rate of gun ownership in the Western world and also one of the highest murder rates. Does most social research find that those two facts are connected?
Well, it's actually very difficult to make the connection because when you're making the connection, you have to compare it to other states and other nations and what their levels are. And we do have the highest rate of gun ownership. That is true. But there are other nations, surprisingly, that have high rates of gun ownership and almost no gun violence. Switzerland, take for instance. Switzerland doesn't have a standing army. They have the old citizens' militia our founding fathers liked. And so they assign to every male at the age of 18 a military assault rifle, the kinds of guns that we're trying to ban here, and a box of ammunition. And they have almost no gun violence whatsoever. I think we have gun problem in part because we have a violence problem in America, and that's what's unique about our culture, unfortunately.
Because it goes back to our history where we had the gunfight at OK Corral as part of our myth?
Well, we all know the image of the Wild West. The gunslinger walks through town, and he's got a six-shooter on each hip, a rifle in his hand, a Derringer hidden in his pant leg. But that couldn't be more inaccurate. Frontier towns had gun control. When Dodge City residents formed their first municipal government, the first law they passed was a ban on concealed carry of firearms, later expanded to ban all carrying of firearms openly.
You had to leave your gun when you entered town, or at least you had to leave it when you went into the saloon.
That's right. When you came into town, you generally had to check your gun with the marshal, or you had to leave it at the stables with your horses. You were not allowed to carry your gun through these towns. In fact, in Gunfight, there's a picture of Dodge City I have, and it looks exactly like you'd expect Dodge City in the heart of the Wild West period to look. A big dusty street, brick and clapboard buildings, a little horse tie in front of the saloon. The thing you're not expecting to see is the big billboard in the middle of the street. It says, "The carrying of firearms strictly prohibited." You weren't allowed to. You had to check your guns like you check your overcoat in a New York winter restaurant.
Legislatures in Virginia and Arizona have taken steps to loosen gun control. In the wake of mass shootings, Virginia allows people to carry concealed weapons into bars now. Why have those legislatures made gun ownership easier in the wake of people shooting, killing people with guns?
Among gun owners, there's a very, very common held belief that more guns will lead to less crime, that if more law-abiding people have guns on the street, fewer people will go commit these kinds of acts.
Do I want to be in a bar where somebody comes in with a gun and the guy next to me or I pull out a gun and we engage in a gunfight?
I think about this when they talk about having guns on campus, and I think of what my classroom might look like if a gunfight breaks out. It wouldn't be very pretty, obviously. But
Ron Paul said that if we'd had guns on planes, we could have prevented 9/11.
I think that's part of the sort of extreme version of this more guns, less crime. If we only had everyone had guns on the airplane, then no one would have been able to hijack it because he would have been instantly met with gunfire.
Do we know that the NRA has a relationship with gun manufacturers? Do gun manufacturers support the NRA?
Well, certainly gun manufacturers support the NRA. The NRA is one of the most successful, powerful political lobbying firms and organizations in America. So, of course, the gun manufacturers, which are not themselves all that strong as a lobby, of course they support the NRA. I don't think the NRA's strength comes from huge amounts of money from the gun manufacturers. Those aren't the biggest corporations in America. They're not the ones whose stock valuation is always skyrocketing. Those aren't rich companies. What we're talking about, why the reason why the NRA is powerful is because they can get a whole bunch of people to turn out to vote. And in a democracy, that's the ultimate form of power.
You're right that disarmament is an unrealistic goal and no more likely to succeed than prohibition or the war on drugs. So do you think that the debate over gun ownership in America is too polarized? Do both sides want absolute solutions?
Well, I think we're Heller really points us in a way, the Supreme Court case, towards a more compromising position. I think that historically, over the last 40 years, we have been pulled in extremes. There's moderates on both sides of this issue. I don't mean to suggest there aren't. But the dominating forces, the dominating voices have been either those who want to get rid of almost all our gun control because we have the right to bear arms, or those who are really hoping to get rid of all the guns. And if we can't do that, let's do anything we can do in the meantime to restrict access to whether it's assault weapons or handguns or whatnot. And those two extremes really have, I think, not done us any great benefit in the gun debate. And the answer to finding good, sensible, effective gun laws is moving away from those extremes.
Well, the one extreme position, the one that we've had in New York City, has been if you have a reason for having a gun, apply for a license. And if you are found to be okay, we will issue the license, allow you to have the gun. Why is that considered extreme?
Well, it's not necessarily what's considered problematic in this sense. If there is a right to have a gun outside of your home, for instance, unclear whether that is a right. But if that right does exist, we shouldn't restrict that right on the basis of the discretionary choice of some government official who's not necessarily directly accountable. In fact, you know, Martin Luther King applied for a concealed carry permit in 1956 after his house was firebombed. But the local police chief was able to, under the law, exercise complete unfettered discretion over who was a proper person for getting a gun. And he's decided, you know what, Martin Luther King, you don't have a good enough reason to have a firearm for self-defense when his life is being threatened. We should never accept any of our constitutional rights to be governed by discretion, unfettered discretion by government officials. Right to bear arms, right to free speech, whatever the right is, that's not how we think of constitutional rights.
Adam Winkler is a professor of constitutional law at UCLA. His book, Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us.
What a pleasure. Thank you.